Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Conversations Live, where we bring you the best in music, books, entertainment, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us. Now, here is your host, Cyrus Webb.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. Whether you're tuning in through Conversations Radio Network, we welcome you. Those joining us on the radio dial in Mississippi at WYAD 94.1 FM, we're glad you all could tune in with us today. As well as joining us on the East Coast in Atlanta at 106 Live, we're glad to have all of you with us as well. Education is one of those things I talk about a great deal on this program. It's one of the things that, of course, has helped me in my own life, and I'm always excited to be able to share it with our audience. A new book came to my attention this year, though, that I think really helps us to look when it comes to school discipline in a different way. It's written by Derek W. Black. He's the author of the new book called Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. We'll talk to Derek not only about the journey of writing this book, but what it was like for him to look beyond the numbers and actually look at individual students and the impact that disciplinary actions actually had on the lives of children that, of course, are molding our future. And if you're just hearing about the book, we'll tell you a little bit later how you can get it for yourself. But Derek, hello to you, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, the pleasure is definitely all mine. You know, any book that I'm introduced to, and I want to definitely thank Javier Perez for introducing me to this book. I'm always excited because, you know, education is one of the things that I believe has helped me in life and has definitely helps us along the way. You know, I think, though, you know, as someone who's not a parent myself, Derek, when I look at how different things are today, you know, I'm always, you know, curious about the ideas about what is fair discipline, what is appropriate discipline, and, again, the impact that it's supposed to have versus what the educator or the administration hopes it does. What was it like for you to kind of to wade into this conversation, Derek, and to give us real examples of how disciplinary actions have impacted the student body?
Yeah, I think it was both enlightening and also an opportunity to reflect on my own experiences and reflect on those experiences of individual families that I've met along the way. I mean, you know, quite often, well, it's always a very personal experience when a student is suspended or corporally punished. And you tend to look at it in the life of this one child, and we hear these stories and we think, well, you know, maybe that's aberrational. But what I try to show in my book is that these aren't aberrations, that rather we have a status quo that is really not responding to the needs of our children, the needs of our schools, but instead is simply, you know, channeling kids out of the school system that they don't want to deal with.
Right, right. And, you know, I think, you know, there will be some who will say, Derek, and I'm sure you've already have heard this, is that, well, you know, if there are rules in place, the student should abide by the rules. You know, if you know you're not supposed to bring certain things at school, you know, you shouldn't bring those things. If you know you're not supposed to do certain things at school, you shouldn't do those things. What I think is so interesting about the book, though, is it talks about individualizing discipline and actually looking at individuals case by case, is that it really allows the child to know or the student to know that they matter as an individual. Was that one of the big overarching things that you saw?
Yeah, I mean, I had a colleague at Howard University School of Law where I used to teach, and he would just say, this is crazy. You know, he would talk about his experience, and he just was sort of flabbergasted but never could put it into words what it was that he was flabbergasted about, other than that school administrators were crazy. I mean, I wouldn't put forward that school administrators are crazy, but I do think that they're not looking at the individual child and what has happened. And as you say, well, some people's response to that is, well, we can't look at every individual child. Let's just set rules. And that might seem reasonable to a certain number of people. We set the rules. Kids need to follow them. But the truth is that anyone who has parents or has children understands that actually children lack the capacity to behave day in, day out from 7 o'clock in the morning until 7 p.m. Part of growing up is misbehavior. Let's be clear about that, right? And kids are going to misbehave at different rates, some more, some less, but it actually is part of growing up. Now, that doesn't mean that we ignore it, but it means that we have to try to treat it as a learning opportunity rather than just a punishment opportunity.
Right, for sure. And I think that is the thing. I mean, and that's why I guess it's so important for us to think about it that way. So I guess an obvious question would be, why this particular topic? As you said, you know, it is one of those things that a lot of people are looking at. I mean, we all hear about zero tolerance and the effect that it has had. Why do you think this was something that you wanted to devote yourself to be able to research and then to write about?
Yeah, two or three reasons. I mean, I think one is my role as a former role as a civil rights attorney, and I still work with civil rights groups, and my role as a law scholar, and said, look, you know, courts ought to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And what I began to see, to my surprise, that on this particular issue, you know, courts were making things worse rather than better. And that was surprising to me. We always think that courts maybe sort of do justice in this area, you know, that's not the case. You know, the other thing that said why discipline was really just, you know, communities and communities of color in particular that have been calling on the civil rights community to do more on these issues. I mean, civil rights communities, and I'm part of that community, have traditionally said, let's focus on integration, let's focus on more money for schools. Now, you know, local grassroots communities, I think, are fine with both of those as a solution. But when I began to be more and more involved in them, what I heard them say was, yeah, more money would be great. You know, a little bit more diversity would be great. But if you're telling me if you ask me what the difference is between my son's ability to start school today and finish as a productive individual 12 years from now, it is school discipline, right, that we have lost so many young people to this schoolhouse, to jailhouse track. So part of it was me responding to communities in need and thinking, what can I do? And then the final point that brought me to this is the idea that this isn't about good kids versus bad kids. And that's often how school discipline is framed. But the more I began to look at the data, I saw that a better discipline system is about producing better education for all kids, both the well-behaved and the misbehaved student.
For sure. And when I'm going to give the example that you actually cite in the book from Toledo, Ohio, something that I just learned about because of this book, for sure. For those who are just tuning in, either on the radio side or online, you're listening to Conversations Live. Derek W. Black is our guest for the segment. We're talking to Derek not only about his new book, Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline, but also, of course, the impact that it has on those that truly matter, those being those molding the future, the students. One of the things that you talk about in the book, in the chapter, the efficiency of policy reform, Derek, you mentioned about this, the communities in Toledo, Ohio, and I want to just share a bit of what you said based on what they were able to realize and the effect it was able to have. Before you talk about Toledo, though, you do mention, for those who have the print edition on page 81, about the Oklahoma City public school districts, and this is what you wrote about them. The UCLA Civil Rights Project, for instance, released a national study of school discipline in 2015 that listed the Oklahoma City public school districts as one of the nation's highest suspending school districts. Within days of digesting the report, the school district voluntarily announced it was ordering an audit of its discipline data and practices that would take steps to bring down the exclusion rate. Then you went on to say this, in communities like Toledo, Ohio, schools have recognized that their high rates of suspension and expulsion are inconsistent with their education missions. A few years ago, Toledo took stock of developing research and decided to implement a proactive and preventive approach to discipline. Suspensions dropped immediately in many of its schools. A school that has suspended 260 students in 1 year under the old discipline policy suspended only 41 students under the new one. What was it like for you to see differences like that, Derek, and how by, of course, the district making the decision to actually look at the information to make a change, how it actually did impact the students?
Yeah, I think one of the things that social scientists have emphasized is that school discipline is as much a function of the leadership of that school as it is of the students. That ultimately, the leaders set the environment, and they determine how students are going to be treated. And when students understand that the school is there trying to move them forward in a better way, right, they tend to respond more positively to that. Not all students, but on average, right, they're going to respond more positively to that. But when students set this sort of hard, might call it militaristic tone to children that says, we don't care about you, we will suspend you at the drop of the hat, that actually does not engender better behavior by a number of children. That doesn't engender the sort of warm and fuzzy feelings that we hope that our teachers and administrators have with students. And so it really is about what is the tone that the leadership wants to set. So oftentimes this conversation, I think some of your questions earlier sort of suggested, is pointing the finger at the student. What's wrong with you? Why can't you conform? And the truth is we need to look in the mirror as adults and say, what are we doing that's causing students not to conform? And what can we do to help them conform more. And I think when you see that sort of night and day sort of change in discipline data there in Toledo, that gives you a sense of that. Now, I also should add, to be crystal clear, that the answer is not to simply say no more suspensions. If what we have is school leadership that says you can't expel kids anymore, you can't suspend them anymore, but I'm not going to help you, or the school district's not going to help you with the resources necessary to manage your school, to help kids get counseling, to deal with sort of different strategies to dealing with misbehavior, then actually things can get worse, right? So the answer isn't leave misbehaving students in the classroom. The answer is how can we go about bringing down misbehavior itself without resorting to discipline, without resorting to suspension or expulsion?
Right. I think that is so true. And, you know, I think you go on to say in the chapter, ensuring quality education through discipline. An interesting fact. Now, I have to say, you know, some that I graduated with, we still stay connected with each other these days, some 25 years later. I was not one of those kids that even got paddled at school, let alone being suspended. So a lot of this, there will be some of us who will say, well, you know, if I could go through school and, you know, and not have it happen to me, versus my brother, who's 3 years younger, who was always in trouble, it seems like, and being suspended. I mean, so I think, you know, there are some who will say, well, you know, it is, you know, a responsibility of not just the student, but also the role of the parent. An interesting thing in that regard that you wrote in the book, Derek, I wanted to share, again, in that chapter I just mentioned on page 187, for those who have the print edition of the book, this is what you wrote, and I want to talk a little bit about what you found in this regard. Research also confirms that misbehavior is often a sign that a student is experiencing academic challenges. The way to address academic challenges is certainly not by excluding a student from school. It is to provide academic support. Moreover, progressive disciplinary approaches, unlike punitive approaches, are better suited to ferret out the causes of misbehavior, whether they be academic, social, or both. Now, I pointed that out because, of course, you go on to talk about in that chapter that there could be other things going on that could cause the child to do what they do. And then, of course, the effect being they end up, you know, being excluded from school, which is where they actually might be helped. What did you find about that connection, about what the student was experiencing when it comes to having problems in school, and that being a result of why, you know, why they were ended up being disciplined, and also things that they were dealing with at home?
Yeah, I think you're stealing a little bit of my thunder, and I appreciate that you really read the book very closely, and I like that. It's good to have that. You know, I think just to frame it a little bit more sharply, if we're talking about misbehavior, we really have to break it down into, you know, at least 2 to 4 categories. So there's this large chunk of misbehavior that is a product of the fact that children are experiencing challenges out of school. And those challenges include poverty, homelessness, dissolution of the family, maybe through divorce or other things, maybe child abuse, right? Maybe it's bullying. So that these challenges a child has outside of the school is going to affect how they behave inside the school. So that's one, and that leads to a certain level of misbehavior. There's this other chunk of misbehavior, which is, I would say, academic-related, as you point out, that when a child actually is struggling to learn, or not getting the material, or doesn't have engaging academic material, that student is either going to be bored, frustrated, or upset, right? And the response to that is to direct, right, their energies elsewhere, which is often misbehavior. So that's another group of kids. Nothing wrong with them. They're just not doing as well in school as we'd like them to do. Maybe that's because it's not a good school. And then there's this third group of kids that have actual disabilities, learning disabilities, emotional behavioral disabilities, or maybe they're just struggling with depression. And those students, ironically, there's a federal law in place that says when these students encounter behavioral problems in school, these students with disabilities, we need to really figure out whether the misbehavior is a product of the disability or it's just regular old misbehavior. The irony, however, is that the students who are suspended at the highest rate in America are children with disabilities, those children that we know have something that's going on as a scientific matter, have something going on that's affecting them in a school system, and we're not responding to that appropriately if they are the most suspended and expelled students in America. And then you've got this fourth group that are just misbehaving because they're unruly or they're growing up, right? And that's a different type of problem, right? And sometimes, you know, tough love works with them, and sometimes it doesn't. You know, sometimes just a conversation, a corrective conversation works with them, sometimes it doesn't. But those first three groups, right, the students experiencing problems outside of school, the students who are struggling academically, and the students who have disabilities, those three groups of students, suspension and expulsion has absolutely no response. It responds in no way to the underlying problem that's causing their misbehavior. So we're simply punishing them for the sake of punishing them, to be quite frank.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I'm always careful with this, Derek, because, again, as someone who does not have children, but, you know, who does spend time working with kids, I understand why there would be, of course, there an idea with those in the school system as well as with some other parents as to why they want their children to be protected against individuals who could be perceived to be a bad influence or perceived to be a problem or a danger even. You address this, I alluded to this earlier, you address it in the chapter Individualizing Discipline because, we look at the news, we look at the horrible things that have happened across this country, some of them at schools. And there are these ideas, of course, the majority of them are not actually from students. But you talk about this in a really frank way, and I want you to talk about how, I mean, this is not something, even though we know this, I think we really know it, but I think getting it to process is sometimes differently. I want to read what you wrote on page 144 of the book, where you're talking about Columbine and some of the other things that have happened. Columbine and other mass shootings, however, do not justify a general disregard for intent. Those shootings, you write, while horrifically tragic, remain isolated events. And then you go on to say this: children are more likely to get hurt or killed crossing a street, leaving school, than they are to be a victim of a shooting at school. Even if the risk of a school shooting were higher, it does not follow that a district should disregard intent. School shootings arise not from accidental or even neglectful actions on the part of a student. They arise from calculated, intentional actions. And again, Derek, this is something that we know. I mean, we know not everyone is going to do something horrific like what we've seen at Columbine and some things even since then. But, I mean, that is something that plays out not only in the minds of parents but also in educators and those who works with schools. I mean, how do you help them to balance that? Because, of course, they have to try to prepare for the protection of those in their care. How do they balance that versus what is best for the children individually?
The one question I think you're getting at is, you know, should we have, or what role should safety play? And if one kid is a threat, can we justify, you know, taking harsh action against one child to protect the rest? And there's a lot of us, there's a lot of individuals say, yes, we should. We will sacrifice the dangerous kid for the benefit of the others. You know, my response to that, you know, number one is, you know, how do we know who the dangerous kid is, first of all, that this is the kid we're going to sacrifice? But I would also say, you know, we need to have a better understanding of what leads to that problem to begin with. And I think a way to maybe try to help understand my point here is to think about the events of last week. So last week, there were two different 14-year-old boys who brought guns to school. One here in Townville, South Carolina, and a second one Ashland City, Tennessee. The one in Townville purportedly took out his weapon and fired on individuals outside of a fence, and a young elementary boy was killed as a result, and two others injured. And it also happened to be the case that there was not a school enforcement officer who works there, right? So this was a school that had no defense, so to speak. The second boy walked in to his school in Ashland, Tennessee with a gun, and he stopped off at his guidance counselor's office on the way in that morning. And it took her 45 minutes. But he told her, I have come to school to kill a police officer and some teachers this morning. It took her 45 minutes, but she talked him out of that, and he gave her the gun. So what do I draw from that? You know, I can't tell any family or any individual that a law enforcement officer in South Carolina would have stopped that shooting? I have no idea whether it would have or not. We haven't really seen that happen that often, but maybe it would have. I have no idea that counseling would have stopped that. But what I do know is that that young man had actually been, or at least been told, that young man had been expelled some point in the prior 2 years for bringing a weapon to school. So this actually wasn't the first time he'd brought a weapon to school. Did we intervene at that point? Did we begin to explore what's going on with that young man? Did we get him social services? Did we try to deal with him? Or did we simply expel him and turn him away until he came back some fateful day years later? I don't really know. But what I do know is that the social science tells us, right, that ostracizing children, arresting children, expelling children does not improve their misbehavior. And they will come back to school at some point, right, unless they're completely expelled. And the social science tells us that our best chance of getting safer behavior and better behavior out of these children is to confront them with social services, to confront them with learning opportunities, to address their needs. And so, yes, it is frightening anytime we see guns in our schools, but our best chance of stopping those guns in school, from stopping those acts of violence in the first place, is to take a proactive approach to meeting the children's needs. And then one last point. This is a long response, but I think it's an important one given the gravity of the situation. Sure. What we have also seen in the last 6 months in particular are any number of videos that students or administrators have taken of law enforcement personnel acting violently towards children who pose no threat to anyone. Here in South Carolina, we saw an officer put a young girl in a headlock who was not doing anything other than being non-responsive. He put her in a headlock, he pulled her out of her chair and drug her across the floor. I would put to you that that act of violence on that young woman did not make a single person in that school safer. And in fact, it did the opposite. It most likely traumatized every child in that classroom and even ones who weren't there, because what they saw was their teacher referring a student to law enforcement. They saw law enforcement acting violently, and they were acting violently not on this kid that they wanted ostracized, but on someone who was probably somebody's sister, somebody's brother, somebody's friend, somebody's long-term peer. And when children see that, they don't feel safer, right? They feel unnerved. And so although our initial reaction is to respond hard and heavy to threats and violence, we are not achieving the results of safer, better performing schools when we do that.
And I appreciate you bringing that up, and I think that is a part of the conversation that definitely needs to be had. Again, everyone, Derek W. Black has been our guest for this segment. Great conversation with you, Derek. The book is Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. So, Derek, I mentioned to you before we went on here that one of the questions I definitely wanted to close with is, what was your hope? I mean, after the time that you invested in this, the research, and the conversations you were able to be a part of, and then writing this book, what were you hoping that we would take away from it when we finished?
At least two things. One is at the local level that harsh school discipline does not work and the communities need to push back. And when they push back, what do they need to ask for? They need to ask for individualized discipline systems that look at what the behavior of an individual student is and what responses will make life better for that student and their peers. Second, demand more guidance counselors and school resource officers in your schools. And then third, when communities cannot get those politically positive results at the local level, and there are schools that are dead set on abandoning our children or throwing our children out under preposterous circumstances, it must be the United States Constitution, it must be civil rights advocates, it must be United States courts that say enough is enough. There are some children who have done nothing that justifies taking away their constitutional right to an education.
Yeah. Well, it's a powerful book, Derek. And like I said, whether you have children or not, I think you know, all of us should read it with some interest because it brings up some points that I think a lot of times we don't think about. And again, it goes to show that whether you have the best intentions or not, again, to think about what is actually best for the child and what actually might be doing more harm than good. The book is available through our friends at Amazon.com. Derek, how can our audience stay connected with you and keep up with updates on the work that you're doing?
Sure. I have a blog called the Education Law Blog. I write on there, try to write on there 5-6 times a week on issues spanning from school discipline to school funding to racial diversity, integration, special education. If it's got to do with education and law, I'm probably talking about it. So that's a good way to follow what I'm doing.
All right. So make sure you all are staying connected with Derek. And Derek, it goes without saying, you're welcome back here anytime. I'm looking forward to staying connected with you.
I appreciate it. I look forward to joining you again sometime soon.
All right, sounds like a plan. Again, we want to thank our good friend Javier Perez for setting up this conversation for us for today. I want to thank all of you for tuning in to another great segment of Conversations Live. If you all came in late, you missed part of the conversation with Derek, don't worry. Thanks to our online friends, you all can catch the replay right after we go off the air. Derek is also on Twitter. I've already tagged him with the link to the podcast, so you all can find it on our page by going to twitter.com/CyrusWeb. You can click on that link, listen to the show completely for free, and share it with your friends from there. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying, as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Make sure you take out time to enjoy some good music as well as a great book. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live today. You all make it a great one.